From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a state lawmaker on protecting Michigan from mass shootings.
I think it's more complex than just saying, well, let's make it harder to get weapons, or let's just ban weapons.
No more long summer vacations for Flint students as the district moves to the balanced calendar.
The old agrarian system of the long summer is in fact a vestige of the past. We don't need kids at home to harvest crops.
Nonprofits picking up the slack in our cash-strapped cities.
They've been very responsive and in some ways are more flexible than governments in their ability to be responsive.
And the latest music from West Michigan, including a big dose of blues.
You know, we're halfway between essentially Chicago and Detroit, so we get those influences.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, we'll talk with the superintendent of Flint Community Schools about their new balanced calendar, a calendar that eliminates the long summer vacation break. But first, we are still unpacking the most recent mass shootings in the country, in El Paso, in Dayton, and just what measures lawmakers could agree on to reduce the threat of more mass shootings. So we turn now to our own state legislature. Representative Hank Vopel is a Republican from Fowlerville. He chairs the House Health Policy Committee. Representative, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Well, Representative, what do you make of, as you watched the coverage of these recent mass shootings from the Gilroy Garlic Festival to El Paso to Dayton? What were your thoughts and feelings?
Well, I had many mixed. First of all, being appalled is probably described my feelings. I think that it's absolutely horrible that we're having the issues, the violence, the killing that we're having. And I think one of the things that stands out to me is all of them, the shooters or however the mass destruction was brought about, all have had some type of mental issues, and all of them have been identified as showing signs early, either through social media posts or interactions with neighbors, interactions with families. And it's I think it shows that with the violence that we're seeing, that it's not just a single faceted thing, but it's many faceted, multifaceted, and it's a situation for all hands on deck. We're not going to solve the violence problem that we're having, the drug problems that we're having, the suicide issues that we're having by one facet of looking at society, but everybody shares responsibility. Everybody shares a part in trying to mitigate the issues that we're having now.
And certainly people are demanding, we're hearing this from coast to coast, that their elected leaders do something. So as the chair of the House Health Policy Committee, what actions do you think need to be taken here in Michigan?
Well, actually, we have identified this as a major issue. Last term, we had the CARES Mental Health Task Force that went around the state. We identified 42 areas and have addressed many of them in legislation, and there's more legislation to do. But I think looking at the mental health system has to be our first priority, and one that runs alongside of the judicial system, the way we handle mental health people, the way we identify, and several of the things that we would want to do and need to do very rapidly is look at the early identification of people with issues, look at early treatment, and have the ability for both the health systems, the schools to identify, the law enforcement to identify, parents to identify, and have a road that they can get help. I've heard from so many people who parents who have tried to get help for their for the children that they had seen, that they realized there was a need for issues. We need the early treatment, and we need wraparound services. We have to be able to treat the mental health, the physical health, the drug addiction things at one time. We can't treat them in silos and expect people to navigate from one to the other to find help.
These are all commendable steps, and we also know the legislature has increased funding for mental health. But certainly, even as we take these steps, it's probably worth noting that mental health experts across the nation are pointing out, first of all, that people with mental health are more likely to be victims rather than perpetrators of violent crime, and that there are other factors that contribute to these mass shootings. In particular, they point to hate, and they point to bigotry and to access to weapons. How do you see us addressing those?
As I said at the beginning, this is an all-hands-on-deck situation. All of those things play into the issues that we're having. The hate, the bigotry, it has to stop. And it's with all of us. It's not just the political leaders that we look at and to work at making legitimate progress and eliminating the hatred and the bigotry that's out there.
Representative, do you think the rhetoric we hear on the campaign trail or on Twitter from our president is a factor?
I think the rhetoric and the social media things that we see from all sides is a factor. I think that I personally would love to see it toned down, all of it toned down. I don't think it helps. And it is all sides. It's not just pointing a finger, say, at our president. I think pointing a finger at everything on the campaign trail that is so divisive it certainly fuels this issue.
What about the access to weapons?
I think access to weapons is something that we would all like to have take the weapons out of the hands of the criminals or the perpetrators. And I have not seen, we have laws on the books to prevent criminals, to prevent people with mental health issues from obtaining weapons, and yet they still do. I just read the article about the weekend in Chicago where there were, 52 or 58 shootings, 7 murders, and they have some very restrictive laws for weapons. The California shootings at the garlic festivals, California has some restrictive laws on weapons. I think it's more complex than just saying, well, let's make it harder to get weapons or let's just ban weapons.
But Representative, why do you think the United States is the only nation where these mass shootings are happening? When you see that list that's been, of flags around the world, and there we are at the United States with 251 this year.
I think the rhetoric in the United States that we have the freedom to do and say and all probably plays into it, because everybody has the right to say, and we do have hate groups out there that flame, and we have hate groups from all sides that are out there doing it. We have to, as a society, accept the responsibility that we are responsible. We have to look at what type of values are we having, from our entertainment industry, our gaming industry, the video games, all of it plays a part. Probably none of it is singularly responsible for the situation, but we all play a part, and we all have to look at what are we doing and accept accountability for what's going on.
But would you agree that when political leanings are made clear in these shooters, that they're on the right?
I think, yes, obviously some of them have been on the right, but I do think that with some of them have just been people who are mentally whatever happens, mm-hmm. that they would that they go out there and shoot. I wouldn't agree that most of them are on the right.
Can you name any that have been on the
left? I would say when you're dealing with mental illness, to say right, left, or anything is probably going beyond what we can honestly say. And as I say, everybody has to work at eliminating this, stopping some of this.
Sure.
And I think to blame the right or the left, I think the pendulum swings very frequently, and I do think that it's all of us, everybody, from the media.
Can you think of any mass shootings that have been committed by anyone on the left?
Right offhand, I don't, but I believe that there have been some. I can't think of right offhand which ones have been on the left, but there have been a lot of them that have not been from people on the right.
You have done a lot on mental health, and as you spell out, you've got some great plans for more to be done. When the state legislature returns, what other efforts do you think would best be put towards reducing the risk of mass shootings in Michigan?
I think the enforcing the laws and regulations that we have now, I think really, really promoting, as the early detection, both in schools, outside of schools. And I think that it's, as I said, the all hands on deck thing. Mm-hmm. Society in general has to accept the responsibility for this. We all, every one of us, has to accept some responsibility and go out there and either tone down our rhetoric or identify people or try to help. There are so many people that need help out there that getting out, every one of us, instead of talking, should be doing.
I know many people will want me to ask you this question, so I'm going to put it out here. What, if any, new restrictions on guns would you be open to discussing, Representative?
I would have to see things. I don't believe that disarming law-abiding citizens is a good answer to anything. I think enforcing some of the laws that we have and looking at the laws to make sure that they are preventing criminals from having weapons, guns, or any other weapons, I think are things that we would have to look at.
Representative Hank Vopel, Republican from Fowlerville, who is chair of the House Health Policy Committee. We want to thank you for taking time with us on Stateside today, sir.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Tomorrow on the program, we'll be joined by Democratic State Senator Rosemary Baer, who's working on a package of gun control measures. Coming up, Flint begins school this week with a new calendar, the so-called balanced calendar. That is next, right here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is time for music from West Michigan as we say hello to John Sinkovich, editor and publisher of Local Spins. And we're going to hear some funky jazz, some blues, and bluegrass this time around. So, John, let's start with Desmond Jones. Tell us about this band and their sophomore album.
So Desmond Jones is a very well-known jam band here in the Grand Rapids area, and which has played more than 200 gigs over the past year or so. So it's really very interesting to listen to their sophomore album, their second album called Hello, Hello, which was just released. And it certainly represents a step forward for this band. I think they've gotten very comfortable performing with each other, obviously, through all these various shows that they've been doing and a lot of the collaborations that they've been doing with other bands. And so this particular album sort of expands their boundaries a bit. They're still funky and jazzy, but they also throw in some elements of prog rock here and there, and they're also testing out material in that Americana country and folk area. The band features five multi-instrumentalists who all met at Michigan State University: Chris Boda, John Nowak, Isaac Berkowitz, George Falk, and John Loria, and they played their first ever shows at Electric Forest this past summer, too, so they've got a lot of experience on the road.
All right, let's take a listen. You've chosen a track called Still Creatures from Hello, Hello. Let's take a listen.
I'm out of sight, I'm out of mind. You can't find me, baby, I don't have the time. Where did it go? I don't know. It makes it sad and put on a different show. Cause we're all still creatures too.
So these guys, if you say all of these dates, playing over 200 shows over the last year,
that really has to inform the way that they're able to work together in the studio, but then also the way they can put it out there when they're in front of a live audience.
Yes, very much like jazz musicians. They feed off of each other musically and vocally. The new album, I think, represents a step up from their debut album as well. They're going to be performing three straight nights at Calpine Music Festival here south of Grand Rapids this weekend, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. They also have a full slate of Michigan shows coming up over the next month or so. They're playing the Sizzlin' Summer Concert Series in Lowell on August 15th, Otis Supply in Ferndale on August 23rd, Union Street Station in Traverse City on August 30th, and they're also doing something special. They're going to have a vinyl release show for this new album on August 24th at Elevation, which is inside the intersection here in Grand Rapids, and the Hacky Turtles and Earth Radio, who we've actually featured on the show before, will also be performing.
Hacky Turtles, my favorite group name ever. And also, I think I'm voting for Calpine Music Festival as my favorite music festival name ever. Terrific. Now we go to blues music, and certainly West Michigan, just think of the geography. What a good meeting up place for blues influences.
Yeah, it's amazing. When I first moved to Grand Rapids, coming from Ann Arbor, the blues thing was really had picked up a lot. We were getting a lot of Chicago blues people who are coming into town and performing here, and it's still the case. You know, we're halfway between essentially Chicago and Detroit, so we get those influences. And this band, James Reeser and the Backseat Drivers, has been churning it out for many years. James Reeser is a very talented harmonica player and singer, and they finally released their debut album. It's called Live Now, Pay Later. And I have to say that it really represents what they do so well, and that is a huge variety of blues. I think they sound a little bit like Los Lobos in terms of their vocals at times, but they really also just feature some really great sort of standard traditional blues as well as some modern stuff.
All right, let's take a listen to a track from their debut studio album. This is Kicking You Out. What do you like about this band?
Well, I like the fact that they're a no-nonsense sort of blues band, and that's really what blues is all about in my view. In addition to James Reeser, they have several talented guys in this band, including Robbie Jewett, who produced the album. He's a bass player who's performed with the likes of Buddy Miles and Dale Watson, drummer Dan Mish, and then there's an up-and-coming guitarist by the name of Marcus Giddings that's also in this band. They recorded this at Decum Records. The band just wrapped up their album release shows, but they're also performing Wednesday before a nationally and renowned star British blues guitarist Davey Knowles. Will be performing here outside Delta Plex Arena for the Summertime Blues Series on Wednesday night, and then they're going to play September 8th in Door, which is south of Grand Rapids, for the Salem Township Park Concert Series.
And with that, we move right on over to bluegrass from the group Full Chord. Tell us about this group.
Well, they've been around for about a dozen years, and I think it's interesting to note that they have been performing during that time period where I found that bluegrass music has really found itself among a huge resurgence, especially here in Michigan. It really appeals to young audiences who love that live jamming and the communal nature of the bluegrass scene. And then those old-timey music fans, you know, the people that probably grew up with Bill Monroe and Earl Scruggs. And a couple of these guys in the band have been together for a long time. They actually met at a bluegrass festival. And Eric Langejohns and Todd Kirchner, they've since added mandolinist Brian Oberlin and fiddler Grant Flick to the scene. They have a banjo player by the name of Luke Gitchell, who also performs with them from time to time. They have a new studio album called Choreomania that officially comes out later this month. And it's really a joy to listen to. And it really reflects their live sort of lightning quick instrumentals as well as their vocals in a style that really swings between that old school bluegrass and what they call newgrass.
Let's take a listen to Full Chord. This is Boneyard Vamp.
Oh, mama, don't put that spell on me. I said, now, oh, mama, you bury me 6 feet deep because you're a bad mama. Put it back on the tree, give me my heart, on a rolling it along.
That does sound terrific. How are they live, and what are some upcoming dates?
So they are actually a lot of fun to watch live. They have this sort of charming nature about them. And as Kirchner will put it, he says that every member of the band was sort of born into bluegrass, so they know the etiquette and the skill behind doing a traditional jam and how to get lost in the vamp behind it all. And so they also bring in influences from other genres, including jazz and Italian music and classical sounds. So when they play live, you never know what to expect. They're going to play Bell's Brewery Eccentric Cafe in Kalamazoo at 8:30 Friday. And then they're also going to play August 16th at the Hoxieville Music Festival in the Manistee National Forest outside Wellston, Michigan. And that's the official album release show. And they're going to follow that up with a show at the Mitten Bar in Ludington on August 23.
Busy, busy, busy. And as always, you can get reviews, news, show dates, and lots more for these and other West Michigan artists. It's very easy. Just go to localspins.com, published and edited by the one and only John Sinkovich. John, thanks so much.
We're going to have to get you to the Cow Pie Music Festival someday. It's a great place to be in the summer.
Sounds great. Thanks, John. People still travel by boat across Lake Michigan. You can hop on the SS Badger in Ludington, for example, and take the ferry to Manitowoc, Wisconsin. But a century ago, it was a lot more common. Passenger steamers were the main way vacationers got themselves up north for the summer. Sean Anchek of the Maritime Heritage Alliance has the story of one steamer's evolution.
Today, from Michigan's maritime past, a story of early shipping on Lake Michigan. When the brand-new 225-foot steamer City of Traverse arrived in her namesake community on May 1, 1871, she was greeted by a large crowd of citizens on hand to inspect the new craft. She was built by the Hannah Lay and Company and became a fascination to behold. The Grand Traverse Herald stated, "The cabins and staterooms are pleasant and commodious and as tastefully and richly furnished as the most fastidious could desire. The beds consist of an excellent mattress of the improved wire support. Beautiful Brussels carpeting covers the floor and the furniture is of handsome black walnut." The residents of the emerging Grand Traverse region were justifiably proud of this new ship. In the first year alone, she carried hundreds of travelers and delivered over 12 million board feet of lumber to Chicago. She also carried grain to Buffalo and Erie. Just 16 years later, in 1887, the forests in northern Michigan had been depleted, the lumber mills sold, and the once proud steamer City of Traverse left the Grand Traverse Bay Area for good, relocating to Chicago. For the next 18 years, she ferried passengers to many ports, including Duluth, Sault Ste. Marie, Houghton, Marquette, and many others. Sadly, in 1905, she became a floating pool and gambling hall, anchored off the Chicago area. Sometime after, she collided with the Wells Street Bridge in Chicago and suffered severe damage. Instead of repairing her, she operated exclusively as a freight vessel. Then, by 1915, she was dismantled and worked as a floating dry dock. A far cry from its start as one of the most luxurious passenger ships on the Great Lakes. Thus was the end for the once glorious steamer, City of Traverse, a well-built ship that served faithfully for nearly 45 years on the Great Lakes. For the Maritime Heritage Alliance, this is Sean Anchek.
That story was produced by Interlochen Public Radio. Flint Community Schools has a new calendar for this new school year, the so-called balanced calendar. Students still get 180 days of teaching like a traditional calendar, but they'll start classes on Wednesday. They'll go to June 18th, and they'll be getting six small breaks of anywhere from 4 to 10 days scattered through the year. Let's talk about this calendar as we welcome Derek Lopez, the Flint Community Schools Superintendent. Superintendent, great to have you on Stateside.
Well, thank you, Cindy, for having me.
So why is the balanced calendar the right thing for Flint?
Well, it's the right thing for kids, for teachers, and for families. For kids, it actually mitigates summer learning loss. And so there's a brain drain that happens when kids are off for the 12 weeks during the summer. They lose information. They lose their ability to do school as readily because they've lost the routine. And so by having a smaller summer break, we actually increase the likelihood that kids will retain information from year to year, and we don't have to ramp up the way that we once have to ramp up for kids in September when they've had that 12-week break. The other piece for kids is that it gives us a chance to remediate kids before they get too far behind. So with the 6 weeks that we actually have, or the 30 to 35 days that we actually have of school, then kids who have missed a unit of information can actually be remediated in the intersession, which are the weeks in between. Instead of waiting for the semester break where they failed and therefore missed a concept, a teacher and or a tutor can remediate what they've lost in that short period of time, so that they can actually progress to the next unit without being behind their kids and behind their peers and falling further behind.
So while these intersessions are going on, these breaks, and it's anywhere, what, from 4 to 10 days, depending?
Yes.
So student who is struggling academically would be going back to class?
They would be going to school for the half day and remediating the unit or the material that they've actually not mastered. So it gives us a chance to get to mastery learning for kids who are struggling, and therefore the first group of youngsters who will be invited to intersession, which is akin to summer school in some small respects, will actually be able to get there to get remediated by a teacher and or a paraprofessional who actually has expertise in that area where they're having difficulty.
And then I guess with a smaller group, they could really drill down on the area that the student's struggling with.
Exactly. That is exactly the point, because small group attention is needed for kids who are falling behind. And oftentimes the school year just doesn't make itself available to that for students in real time.
And has data shown that having this kind of balanced calendar, does it indeed prevent brain drain, that summer brain drain?
Yeah. So that's the theory. This is a part of the Michigan Department of Education's top 10 in 10 strategies. Very few school districts in Michigan have adopted it, but whole states like Tennessee have adopted it. And they have shown that, in fact, the old agrarian calendar, which is what the long summer break is based upon, is actually mitigated. We mitigate summer learning loss when we go to this balanced calendar, which are shorter breaks as opposed to the longer summer break.
And Flint, I know one of the elementary schools in Flint has been trying this balanced calendar for the last 3 years. How did parents receive these schedule shifts? I'm wondering, especially working parents.
Yeah, so I said it was good for parents in the first segment, because parents know that the students who are actually, if they need childcare, the schools are open. And so our community school directors, in partnership with the Crim and Fitness Foundation, will actually be there for kids who actually need enrichment as opposed to remediation. And so these intersessions are not just for kiddos who are struggling, but it's also for kiddos who are actually who may need enrichment or parents who need childcare. So there's a first wave of kids that will be invited who are having mastery challenges. And there are the second wave of kids who are parents that just simply need childcare. And so what parents have found is that instead of having to find instead of having to find care for the entire summer, they find care for the 6 week summer program, and then they can go right back to school, and as well as for the intersessions. We have availability for parents in our schools.
Are you limited, Superintendent, by any caps on the number of kids or families that could take advantage of these intersessions?
Yeah, so we do have some limitations with respect to funding, because it's funded through Title I, but at Freeman, every parent who needed it received it, and so we believe that we'll be able to offer the same for parents throughout the district.
How about teachers? How do they feel about it?
Yeah, so teachers voted for this. We actually had a tentative agreement with our teachers union, UTF, because they recognized the benefits of it. The other thing of it is that teachers can then go on vacation in September and in November and in February and in May, when everybody else is trying to get off in the summer and go on vacation. So they have actually the window for vacations where they're actually cheaper. And so it gives teachers a natural break while also giving them the opportunity to afford vacations that they may not otherwise take. But teachers will work with principals to determine when they're off and what intersessions they're working. So that gives them some control of their calendar.
And if a youngster has the right appropriate daycare and is not academically struggling, then that intercession is a break.
It is a break, and so we are offering enrichment in all of our buildings, but it is a break for kiddos whose parents may choose to take them on vacations during that time. But yes, it is a break.
What do you see? You're about to mark your first year as the Flint Community Schools superintendent. What do you see as the biggest challenges Flint schools face?
So I would say this. I would say that the biggest challenges are not knowing what we're going to receive because of the crises that our kids have been in from the students that are sitting in front of us. We actually have the first set of kiddos that are coming to us as kindergartners who were actually in the epicenter of the water crisis. And so we don't know what is going to present itself with respect to special needs within the community of Flint right now. And that is a huge challenge. We are already at about 24% special needs, which is double the average for the state of Michigan. And we are looking to probably increase that number as a percentage of our student population because of the challenges that our kids have faced with the water crisis. So I think that, coupled with the financial stress of that, is really the biggest challenge that we're facing here in Flint right now.
All right, let's talk about how you measure success of the balanced calendar. Let's look ahead. After a few years of having Flint kids on this balanced schedule, what do you think you'll be able to tell us? How will you know if it's succeeded?
So I'll know if it's working, and if kids are engaged, if teachers are engaged, and if teachers and parents are refreshed during these breaks. We'll know based upon the affect as well as the effect of our test scores and the work that we're doing in the buildings if we're doing a good job. Really, how we treat one another during this time is critical, because we forget fundamentally that we're actually in the business of human-to-human interaction. And if the human-to-human interaction increases in efficacy, then our kids will learn, and our work will show itself in the results that they have around their social emotional behavior as well as in academics. And so that's what we'll see in the next couple of years when this balanced calendar has fully been implemented.
Is the balanced calendar something that you think all school districts in Michigan should go to?
I actually do. I think that one of the things that is clear is that the old agrarian system of the long summer is in fact a vestige of the past. We don't need kids at home to harvest crops. And so the idle time, as my grandmother used to say, is a devil's workshop. And so one of the things that kids need is they need enrichment when their parents don't have means. The school system is the locus whereby they can get enrichment when they need it. And so the goal really is for us in the city of Flint to make sure that our kids actually have productive time and that we actually cultivate that time for their growth and development. And I wish that many more school districts in the state of Michigan would also do the same.
Derek Lopez is the Flint Community Schools superintendent as the entire district prepares to launch the new school year on the new balanced calendar. Thank you so much for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thank you, Cindy. Have a great day.
Coming up, we look at how nonprofits and foundations fill the void for cities struggling to make ends meet.
They've been very responsive and in some ways are more flexible than governments in their ability to be responsive.
That comes up next, right here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What happens when a cash-starved city loses its grip on the ability to govern and provide basic services for its residents? New research from Michigan State University shows nonprofits and foundations are stepping in to fill the void in Michigan cities, such as Detroit and Flint. Sarah Reckow is an associate professor of political science at Michigan State. Sarah, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah, just explain to us what we're seeing happen in Detroit and Flint with the role of these nonprofits and these foundations.
So there's a few things that have been going on that I've worked on a study with Davia Downey from Grand Valley State and Josh Sapochny here at Michigan State with me. And we've looked at how the size of local government has changed and then how nonprofits have become involved in these cities, especially after both cities experienced fairly significant public sector crises. We're very familiar, of course, with the Flint water crisis here in Michigan, as well as the bankruptcy in the city of Detroit. Both cities experienced these crises, which directly impacted their local public sectors, but also in a context where the local government had been cut back quite a bit over many years leading up to the time of the crisis.
Yes, very much. I mean, emergency managers in both cities.
Yes. And even before the emergency mm-hmm. managers. So the emergency managers, in some sense, accelerated some things that were already going on, especially in Flint. And what has happened is the nonprofits came along in many respects to take on roles that filled services and needs that residents had. I mean, if you think about the Flint water crisis, there was an immediate need to provide drinking water to residents, respond to health needs and other aspects of the way the crisis was affecting people. But in Detroit, it's come down in all kinds of other ways surrounding local development and neighborhood redevelopment efforts where nonprofits are playing a role in areas where you normally expect city government to be the leading player. And this comes through in funding, in decision making, and in on-the-ground service delivery in both cities.
As you've put it rather elegantly, you've got nonprofits doing heroic work, but they shouldn't be providing basic public services.
That's what we're trying to shine a spotlight on, is something that I hope people will question, at least, is whether this is sustainable and whether it's the kind of thing we would expect in other cities. We might take it for granted if you live in a Bloomfield Hills or other mm-hmm. cities in Michigan that you have a local government that's going to do all kinds of things for you. Leaf collection, recycling, you have strong public safety, you don't question things about your drinking water supply, and yet we've allowed this condition to persist in Detroit and Flint, also cities in Michigan, and we want to draw attention to what's been going on.
It is rather eye-opening that you point out that Detroit's and Flint's governments shrunk far greater than their populations declined, so it's being hollowed out.
Absolutely.
Is this unique in the nation? Is there precedent that has been set elsewhere on these type of public-private partnerships where you're seeing the nonprofits taking over?
So it is not entirely unique. I think what Detroit and Flint present is more extreme examples where the extent of the hollowing out of government is larger and you compound that with the specific crises that occurred. But if you look at cities like Baltimore, for example, you're going to see comparable situations in certain areas where nonprofits have played a very large role, private funders, some of the redevelopment efforts on the east side of the city look very similar to some of the things going on in Detroit in terms of private money and who's involved in decision making. So it's not completely unique. We just think that these examples are the more extreme cases.
Sarah, what are the possible strengths and the possible pitfalls of seeing these strong foundations stepping in where government should be?
It is important to point out some strengths. I mean, they've been very responsive and in some ways are more flexible than governments, especially noteworthy with the Flint water crisis, where there was a need for such immediate response, some on-the-ground knowledge there. And so the work of the United Way and the Community Foundation and organizations there simply to coordinate efforts across all sorts of groups that were coming into the city and keep that effort going is worth celebrating. And nonprofits, depending on how they operate, they can sometimes be closer and more responsive to communities. What also happens, though, are nonprofits can be more responsive to their funders mm-hmm. or to other interests. And one of the examples we bring up in the paper is the case of the Q Line or the M1 rail in downtown Detroit, which has added another transit option in the city. But it's important to point out how small that is as a service. Most transit users in the city of Detroit live in neighborhoods that are not at all accessible to the mm-hmm. corridor of the Q Line. And that is a large part of a very privately funded and nonprofit managed transit line, which is, of all things you would expect, public sector involvement, infrastructure would be right there at the top.
Who gets left behind when struggling municipalities partner with these groups?
People can be left out when local government leads to. Local government is not always perfect in how they operate. But I think as a general point, the issue that more vulnerable people in cities who are going to depend on having some kind of baseline of public services that you don't necessarily have to constantly advocate for or have special access in order to make your voice heard are potentially going to suffer. And when you think about things like parks maintenance in the city of Detroit, which now relies very heavily on private funding and private partnerships and is focused a lot on certain areas of the city. You go to the riverfront area where there's the Detroit Riverfront Conservancy, you know, a public-private partnership. You have the corridors in the downtown area, and they look beautiful, and there's beautiful grass, and things are taken care of, and there are flowers. And then you go out to some of the neighborhoods around Detroit, and you get a much more mixed picture of the shape of maintenance of parks that people would probably very much like to be able to use, but are looking at high grass or, you know, broken equipment. So can you maintain a parks department that has a staff that can actually do the day-to-day work that it takes to have a city with good public space for the entire population?
If you've just joined us, I'm speaking with Sarah Reckow, who's an associate professor of political science at Michigan State University, as we talk about nonprofit philanthropies, governance, and cities. Could we, now that you've done this research and really thought about this, Sarah, could we envision a future where a CEO potentially has more say than a mayor over how a city's functioning?
I think that is entirely possible, though I think it's important, if we're speaking about the specifics of Detroit, that Mayor Duggan and the city in the post-bankruptcy era has regained some important capacity. And we talk about this in the paper, that there's a difference between Flint and Detroit. And the bankruptcy did allow Detroit to step out with somewhat stronger footing, and Flint is in a tougher position. But that being said, Duggan is facing a situation where he relies quite a lot on partnerships with corporations, negotiating with folks like Dan Gilbert and the Illich family, and they have a lot of power. I think everyone who follows City of Detroit politics is very aware of that.
So should there be more regulation or oversight of foundations and nonprofits that make decisions or craft visions for municipalities?
I mean, this is an interesting question. What is the approach? If we acknowledge there's reasons to be concerned about this, is it regulation? Or on the other hand, would it be a question of thinking about how cities, the resources that actually come into the public sector? Could we strengthen our public sector so that when you have a problem, when you need, you know, money to maintain your parks, or when you need money to upgrade infrastructure, you don't go out hat in hand and ask for corporate money? Instead, you actually have adequate tax revenue coming in to fund these public services that we all depend upon. And the truth is that the state of Michigan has policies that make it kind of hard for local governments, especially in cities like Detroit and Flint, with a lot of legacy costs and population loss. It makes it very hard to maintain their services.
Yes, it certainly seems like your paper is kind of challenging these state policies that have so limited local governments and, we should say, school districts' ability to pay the bills, pay for the personnel and the infrastructure. So they've got that incentive to seek private funding.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that really struck me as a anecdote related to this research from the fall was when the Detroit and Flint school systems had to seek private funding to ensure their students would have clean drinking water in the schools, because Flint, of course, has had the long-term lead issue. And then the Detroit schools tested their water and found high levels of lead. And so they were going to install drinking water stations. And in Flint, they got funding from Elon Musk, the billionaire, and Detroit received private funding from several foundations around the city. If you look at the way Michigan funds school facilities, we rely on local property taxes. And Detroit and Flint have really struggled in that area because property values became so depressed for so long in those cities.
Are these relationships sustainable well into the future? Because it takes time to fix things, to move a municipality in a better direction. I guess I'm saying it seems like an awful lot could be lost if the relationship becomes fraught, or a mayor or the president or CEO disagree on the path forward for the city.
It does put public officials in the position of having a pretty big investment in making sure they are on the good side of people who can offer them resources. You could suffer in the long run if you've angered the people who are in your kind of elite business class, and then the next time you're trying to seek partners for a project or hoping they might expand their businesses, they are not very happy with you at all, and maybe they want to leave the city. This is not new in city politics by any means. I do think what happens when the public sector is this eroded, it simply adds more power to the private sector side of that power dynamic.
Who do you hope will read this research you've done.
I hope that people who are involved with state politics will take some time to pay attention. I know there's been discussion about the emergency manager policy and revising that, and that would be a step. But the reality is there are bigger aspects of the way the state governs the finances of localities, whether it's revenue sharing, which was cut back for many, many years and has really not recovered, or the ways that cities face tax and expenditure limits, which can make it hard to raise revenue at the local level. These things really affect the flexibility of cities to make sure that public services are adequate as needs change, as the costs of infrastructure and other things can change and go up over time.
Sarah Recco is an associate professor of political science at Michigan State University. Her research looking into the way that nonprofit philanthropy groups have been getting unprecedented involvement into how cities like Detroit and Flint are governed. Thanks for speaking with us, Sarah.
Thanks very much for having me.
There is something new greeting visitors to the Flint Institute of Art. Beginning today and running until September 4th, a shiny Airstream trailer is outside the museum. It's StoryCorps, all set up in Flint and hoping to gather stories in its mobile booth for the next month. Danielle Anderson is Associate Director of the StoryCorps Mobile Tour. Danielle, why did you choose Flint as this latest location for a mobile booth?
Oh, goodness. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. Second, Flint was when you guys reached out to us, when Michigan Radio contacted us about this tour, this was where you guys were interested in going, and we were all on board for that. We were really excited to be to Flint. We've never been there. The mobile tour has never been there, but we're building on work that the Flint Public Library has been doing with StoryCorps for some time, and so it just seemed like a natural place for us to go.
So tell us, for those who are not familiar, how does it work? What happens inside the mobile booth?
So it's really quite simple. The only thing that needs to happen is that you need to make an appointment. But anybody can make an appointment. It's a free public service. But once you arrive to the booth, you're greeted by one of our trained staff people, one of our facilitators. And that's the person that walks everybody through the process. It's 40 minutes of recording time for you to sit down with somebody you care about or somebody you're curious to learn more about and, you know, just take some time to ask some questions, right, and do some listening, things that we often don't have time to do in the midst of our busy lives.
And who can participate, and really even more, what kind of stories do you hope to gather?
Yeah, so anybody can sign up. We really want anybody that's interested to come in and participate in this, to share their voice and add it to our archive. As for what we're looking for, we're actually not looking for any particular kinds of stories. I mean, we're in Flint because we'd love to hear some stories from Flint residents, but as to what they talk about, we really don't care. Hmm. We want people to use this space in a way that's going to be meaningful for them, right? If that means sharing family history, that's what we want to hear. If that means sharing community history, that's what we want to hear. What we really want to hear is what's important to people.
How do you sell this to the people in Flint, Danielle? Because as you know, they've had journalists from all corners of the world coming in to tell their story. How is this different?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and one that we have been kind of thinking through as thoughtfully as possible. We don't want to be one of those media organizations that's just dropping in to pull stories out and then leaving, right? And so we're really approaching it just kind of like I said, this is a space for people to talk about whatever is important to them, right? To add to this moment in time, this archive that we're creating, what does it mean to live in Flint right now? What does it mean to raise a family there? What does it mean to be in community in Flint, right? And how people interpret that and how people choose to tell their stories, it's entirely up to them, right? My goal really is to just make people aware that the opportunity is there, right? And if they want to take advantage of it, we really want them to come in.
Anybody from Flint, come in with your stories. And again, you say all they really need to do is make an appointment. And how do they do that?
So they can do that on our website, and I believe there's also a link from your website. Mm-hmm. It's just storycorps.org, and there's a link under Participate directly to Flint, and you can just sign up there. It is a good idea to think about who you might want to come in with first. and make sure they're available for that time. But yes, that is how you make an appointment.
Well, the StoryCorps mobile tour at the Flint Institute of Art beginning today and running until September 4th. You can go to StoryCorps.org or MichiganRadio.org to get an appointment and get in and share this story, whatever your story is. Danielle Anderson, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up tomorrow on Stateside, the role of midwives has been changing over generations. Midwifery is gradually becoming a more mainstream option for expectant moms. Beginning this month, midwives in Michigan must now have a license to practice in our state.
Yes, it allows for our profession to become more stable so that we can grow.
The future of midwifery in Michigan, that comes tomorrow on Stateside. And time for our regular reminder that we love when we get story ideas from you. Who or what do you know about that you'd like to share with the rest of Michigan? What story has your interest? And who are the people doing something special to make our state better? It's easy to reach us and let us know. Just email us by writing to stateside@michiganradio.org. We're on Facebook, search for Michigan Radio, Twitter at Stateside Radio, and always you can go to the Stateside page at michiganradio.org and click the link that says Stateside.